Good morning, good morning. Apparently. How are you doing? Welcome back. We're on Roman time. Israel time, that's true. Okay, how's everybody doing? Anybody freezing? Just me. All right. I guess it's just me. Okay, so you have on your sheets before you one of the central exchanges of Moses and Pharaoh, of Moshe and Paro, which we'll get to today. Again, just to do an overview of the Parsha. Parsha this week is Parshat Bo. How many plagues happen in Parshat Bo? Three. Right, we went over this a little bit last week. How do we know three happened in Bo, even if we hadn't read it? Because Bo, Bet Aleph, is three. Very convenient, very helpful, easy to remember. Now, what are the three plagues that happen in Parshat Bo? Which ones? The last three. Well, let's work back. What was the last one? Right. The firstborn, darkness, and locusts. Now, so the parasha opens, and I remember, I'm warming up a bit now. I mentioned last week that I had told my daughter the story of everything that happened in Parshat Shemot and then left it on in suspense before Parshat Va'era, and she got very excited. I did the same thing last week. And also, we're left in suspense. I went through the seven first plagues. She was kind of rapt with attention about the horrors of what struck the Egyptians. And then after the last plague, hail, everything's been battered. The fields have been broken. Trees have been shattered. Warehouses have been knocked down. And I told her that hail is like snow. Is it hot or cold? She said, oh, cold. I said, fire. Is it hot or cold? She said, fire is very hot. And I said, well, this was hail with fire inside it. She was very excited by that possibility, that it would come down with, it would be hard. It would lash them and then spread fire. And it's horrific. And then I said, and then Pharaoh said, please come, we'll let you go. Moshe came. And then did Pharaoh let them go? No. Said he changed his mind again. And then Moshe said, oh, something big's coming now. And she said, what? And I said, we're going to have to wait till next week to find out. She said, oh, just tell me a little bit, please. So I told her a little bit, but we start this week. We have the plague of locusts. But before the plague comes, we have one of the most protracted exchanges between Moshe and Paro. There's a back and forth. Moshe and Aaron almost convince him as Moshe walks away. Pharaoh's servants say, Pharaoh, come on, this is crazy, let him go. And they bring Moshe back, and then Pharaoh goes through the deal. All right, so who's going? If we're going to talk about this, let's talk about this. I need a list, I want to understand what's happening. Moshe goes through, who's going? Pharaoh says, I'm not having that. A small group's going, that's it. Moshe says, no, walks away and he leaves. God then tells him to lift up his hand. He says, lift up your hand, Ba'arba, al Eretz Mitzrayim. How do you translate Ba'arba? Well, Arba can mean to multiply, but in this context, it means locust, right? The plague of locusts. But it says, lift up your hand, Ve'yal Yad Ba'arba. Right, how do you literally translate it? I mean, you may feel silly saying it, but what's the literal translation?
In locust, or
Ba' can mean sometimes with. Locust, right? Lift your hand up. Ba'arba with locusts. A lot of the commentaries say, oh, it means to make the plague of locusts happen. Lift your hand up to generate the locust, but that is a stretch. And a number of the rabbinic commentaries say lift up. Ba'arba literally meant he had to lift up a locust. And it was kind of a signal to get things started. There's a view that he had a locust that he stuck on the end of his staff and he lifted it up. And actually, it's fascinating to think about the mechanics of how all these plagues unfolded. We said last week, boils began. It wasn't just Moshe said, Alakazam, or like, bring on the boils. He had to reach into a kiln, lift up ash, throw it up. The very specific ritual triggers for these plagues, and it sounds like, at least for a number of the commentaries, to stalk locusts. It wasn't enough just to lift up his staff or to kind of say something, but one view is he had to lift up Ba'arba, meaning he had to lift it up and shout, Arba, to get it going. But there had to be some sort of trigger, And again, what's the point of these triggers? Is it so that the Egyptians understand this isn't by chance, that this is actually being done? They can't just say, oh, so a swarm of locusts happened to come in. But Moshe clearly triggered this by doing something. He said, Arba, and they all came. It's hard to argue it was coincidental. All sorts of things to look into with that. Either way, the loaves have come. It's pretty devastating. They eat everything up. Nothing is left. Not a single thing is left. And they're all over the whole of Gvul Mitzrayim. So this seems to be a geographic assault. And the land is left with nothing. No grain, anything. The hail destroyed. The hail shattered the economy. They didn't have their stores anymore. They didn't have the trees anymore. But this just rid them of everything. They were now on the verge of starvation. And in fact, Vayimaher, it says that Pharaoh hurried Moses in. This is one of the only times. He's actually got a sense of urgency. He says, please remove Raket Hamavet Hazeh, this death from Egypt. No other plague is described by Pharaoh as being death other than locusts. And you would have thought the boils or the disease, the blood or the frogs, you would have thought something along the lines would have felt fatal. But the locusts were death. And as far as plagues go, the locusts didn't attack the people, right? They ate the grain. All right. So they went through my pantry, but why is that death? And say, so the economy, starvation, you don't eat, it's a problem. Rav Hershesh has an interesting point that the way locusts function is they eat up everything and then they lay larvae in the ground, which then sprout every year. And this was like a death knell to Egypt. This wasn't just a one-off strike. This wasn't, we're going to eat everything. Okay, but guess what? It's like when you have a bad haircut. Hair grows for most people. Yeah, sorry. but here, the grass will grow back. So the understanding of Hershes is this is not going to, and when it grows back, it's going to be eaten up again. They have infested the ground with locust eggs. And he says, that's why he said, V'yaser me'alai, remove from me, not just stop the locusts or get rid of them, but please rid the country of these things. This will be the end of us as an empire. I don't know. Good question. They often have storms of locusts around that area. I think they, yeah, because people enjoy sending the pictures around when they happen. They say, look, a plague of locusts in Egypt.
This year in Kenya, there's a 75-year locust.
Say that again?
In Kenya this year, there's a 75-year infestation of locusts.
What does that mean? Every 75 years?
Largest infestation of 75 years.
Oh, really? There you go. Yeah, it can be terrifying. And even though they don't attack people, they do come as a swarm. I imagine it's horrific. I mean, my wife says she went to Baltimore once to visit family, and it was on, there's a 17-year cycle of cicadas. And whenever...
Oh, yeah, here too.
Okay, I'm out. Right? They have them here?
Yeah.
How many, how often?
All the time. No.
I don't think I saw any last year in the summer. Oh, you just hear them. All right. Hearing them, I'll be okay with. In Chicago, we had them as well. They're revolting. And then they kind of, when they die, they got to drip out the trees. I was walking with someone, landed on their shoulder once. Yeah, they seemed okay with it. They didn't embrace it. They just seemed okay with it. I'm not okay with that. That's why we moved. Yeah, and they're so noisy. These tiny little things make a horrendous noise. Either way, don't know why. Oh, yes, locusts. It's relevant. We're talking something about... So in Baltimore, my wife said, when they had one of these, they literally had to take brooms and like wipe down the front doors because they just plaster the houses everywhere. And again, they don't really eat anything. I mean, sure, they eat something, but they don't destroy crops. And that's a plague. So this is Raket Hamavet Hazet. Now, there's a lot to talk about these locusts. There are Midrashim that say, locusts seem pretty tame. They had lions and tigers like a week ago, and now you've got some locusts. So the economists are going to panic, but what does the average person know about the larvae and the annual cycle? Why did this terrify the Egyptians? And the Midrashim that suggested actually these were not ordinary locusts. There's a vivid description. If you were trying to imagine... a comic villain version of the plagues, where these locusts were not normal size, but larger than human beings. They had the back of a snake, the teeth of a lion, the feet of an ox, all these, the thighs of a horse. I mean, it actually seems a little weird, but there are these vivid descriptions of these alien creatures that come in. And Rak et hamavet hazeh, I guess I'm going to give away something that I could use another time, but why not? Rak seems very strange to be put there. Remove from me just this death. What do you mean, just this death? Just say, V'yaserim alay et hamavet hazeh, remove from me this death. What are you saying? Remove from me just this death. I mean, it's poetic, I guess. What's his name in the Ten Commandments? Who is Pharaoh? Yul Brynner. I can see him saying, remove from me just this death. It sounds Shakespearean, but what does it mean? There's one of you that Pharaoh's again trying to think about how to take advantage. Locusts were edible, they're food. He's saying, remove from me the live ones, leave the dead ones, we'll eat them. Remove from me the damage, and let me have the ones that are, you know, we sell these things. Right, meaning if they were crazy cows that had gone wild, he wouldn't say, get rid of all the cow. Say, get rid of all the deadly cows, we'll keep the meat. That's the equivalent of what he's saying. But there's another view that, how else could you punctuate Resh Kuf? We've read it, V'yaser malai rak et hamavet hazeh. Rake. What's rake?
Empty.
Now what's rik?
Hevel v'rik.
Hevel v'rik. What's rik? Correct, not a chet, but saliva. And there is a midrash that says, V'yaser ma'alai rik, remove from me saliva, this saliva, tamavet hazeh, this death, which again generates a midrashic tradition that it wasn't just they were terrifying and they were eating everything up, but actually they had saliva that was poison, was a toxin, was fatal. So if they bit you, you were dead. They did attack the people. They were people came in contact with these salivating, slobbering things that actually kill them. Yeah, it reminds you a little bit of Men in Black, maybe. But either way, it was a huge problem. And actually, it's been suggested in the past that with poetic license, move from me, Rick, saliva et hamavet hazeh, we don't have to go down the mythical route where these creatures had some sort of deadly saliva, but actually, when these creatures came and ate everything up, the food stores were the lowest they'd ever been. Pessimism had become pervasive. And for the first time in his life, Pharaoh felt something. What did he feel for the first time in his life? He'd never felt before. Vulnerable in a very unique way. He must have felt some level of vulnerability at the other place, but there's something he's never felt before that I imagine every single one of us in this room has felt at some point in life, even if only once a year. Hunger. He's a king of Egypt. Again, you don't have ritual fast days. We live in a world, thank God, where many of us, if we didn't have to fast on occasion, would never really feel hunger in the real sense. There are moments you feel, you know, I need busy food, or if, you know, we'll say I'm starving, but really we're not starving. And, you know, sometimes you skip a meal by mistake or you get busy. But hunger, Pharaoh had everything he wanted all the time. This is the first time in his life where there is something inside him making demands of him. He's the one who gives orders, and now his body's telling him what he needs. We need food. So, well, leave me, I make the decisions around here. Don't tell me what I need. And it was his saliva that was death. He says, this, I'm salivating. I've never felt this before. I've never felt starvation or hunger or vulnerability, that the taste in my mouth is not the thing I ate 10 minutes ago because I'm having to ration. And hunger can actually be just the feeling of hunger as a source of death. And that was the plague that he felt. Rake, remove from me this saliva, this death. All right, I can't use that again now. All right, it's been recorded. Either way, that's a thought about the plague of locusts. All right, good. That's the plan. The plan is no one remembers. I'll now distract you with all sorts of other things. Okay, so that plague comes. Pharaoh summons them in. They're removed. And it says that The west wind came, blew all the locusts, not a single one was left. And it's a very strange formulation. It says, all the locusts were blown out of Egypt, not a single one was left. And if we're focusing on redundancy and excess, if you would have told me all the locusts are gone, God's pretty credible. I know a lot of talk in the public sphere about who's credible, who's not credible, who's coming out with a book. God came out with a book. It's been approved. And it's pretty credible. So if God tells me all the locusts were gone, I believe him. Why does he then need to say, not a single one was left? If you doubt me, if you think I'm being hyperbolic, not a single one was left. Why the need to emphasize not a single one was left? Say again? Oh, so interesting. Maybe this is a supporter of Hirsch. Not only have all the kind of flying beasts gone, but all the eggs are gone. Everything, not a single one was left. And so they wouldn't have problems today as a result of that because the larvae are gone, according to that reading. The Midrash picks up on something that we mentioned a moment ago. The dead ones. Right. Because the Egyptians were almost like, Moshe, you're saying this is a plague? We just got a massive delivery, right? They all came. Yeah, it was irritating for a while. They're all dead now. We could eat for years just on the carcasses of these locusts. We're going to make a whole cottage industry out of this. We're going to be, come get your locusts in Egypt, provided for by the slaves' God. So all of them were gone. The dead ones, the live ones, and the Midrash paints in a very, well, critical picture that the Egyptians just didn't get the message. The plague came, the locusts were there, then they thought, fantastic, now we got food. And they're like, you guys just don't get it. So everything had to go, wiped about. So nothing was left. We then have a strange moment where the ninth plague, there's no warning. A number of times plague, there's actually a very interesting pattern in which if you split the plagues into 3, 3, 3, and 1, like we do at the Seder, Datsach, Adash, V'achav, that there's a pattern. The three is not just incidental, it's not just a convenient formulation, but actually the first, second, and third pattern repeats. And the third one never has a warning. Moshe doesn't go to Pharaoh and say, let us go, or. It just comes. And that's what happened. The locusts disappear. And then there's no contact between Moshe and Pharaoh. God just says, lift up your hand, may Al HaShamayim, which means literally above the sky, over the heavens. It's again a very strange formulation. And the mechanics of how to generate darkness. Lift up your hands, may Al HaShamayim, over the heavens, darkness will come. We didn't warn Pharaoh. No one went to give him a chance that we're just bringing a plague. And at no point does it sound like Pharaoh reacted to the darkness and said, come and stop it. At the end of darkness, we're not told. It says it was dark for 3 days. They couldn't get up for 3 days. And then later, Pharaoh says to Moshe, come to the palace. But it seems to be that there were just plagues. It was just recurring pain, sometimes with exchanges with Pharaoh, sometimes not. They were just constantly being assaulted. So Moshe lives up to the heavens. Darkness comes, v'yamesh choshech, and it's a thick darkness. Or it's tangible in some sense. There's a midrash that I've no idea what to do with. I'll say yet, because we should always think that we can at some point find something to do with it that says, how thick was the darkness? Because we're being told it had a thickness. What's the density? And we're familiar with the midrash, how thick the darkness was? Yeah? So there's a description of the people in the darkness, but rabbinic texts want very specific measures, right? Meaning, you've seen people with their etrogs on sukkahs, they got the things, right? People are looking closely. It says it was the thickness of a dinar coin. Yeah, I feel the same way. I know what that means. I know what on earth that means. And the dinar coin is used as a measure of thickness in a few different instances, actually, because, again, when I saw that midrash, I was intrigued. And it comes up in places that don't seem to have any connection, and it's hard to figure out. It's due to the kashrus of a spleen in Gemara in Cholin. If it's thicker than that, it's not a trefa. If it's that, but again, I don't know how to figure out to get from trefas to the darkness in Egypt. But again, there are those homiletically have said it was as thick as a coin, meaning this was a punishment for materialism and economic exchange and exploitation. Which is an interesting avenue. Either way, the darkness came, the darkness left. How long was the plague? So 3 days, but it says 3 days twice. So Rashi presumes that there were 6 days of darkness and they got progressively worse. Three pretty bad, three far worse, when they couldn't get up. The first three, it was just dark. The next three, it says they couldn't, velokamu, they couldn't get up, mintachtav. That's the second set. Okay. At this point, Pharaoh summons Moshe and says, all right, you can go, but just leave the animals behind. At which point, what does Moshe say? They're coming with us. Now, if I were the children, if you're the children of Israel, how would you feel at that point? Right. Pharaoh just said, all the people can go, just leave the animals. And Moses says, we're staying. Which point I can imagine a few of his advisors going, Moshe, you've just been given a green light to all the people to go. Now, Peter has not been founded yet. I don't mean the Christian leader. I mean the, what does it stand for, Peter? What's P? Oh, people. People for the ethical treatment of animals. Not been founded yet. This is about freeing the Jews, not freeing the Jews and the animals. And if the animals go free, we're going to make them work for us anyway. So it's not going to make a difference. Why on earth are you saying no? And his answer is, we need the animals to serve God. Again, how does one justify Moshe having said no at that point? He's been given a green light. Say again. Right, so it's possible. He's saying, what use is freedom if we can't eat? We need to live a life. This is not just about the injustice of your possession of us, but we need to live as a free people. We need to have a sustainable possibility. I'm not going to jump into politics, but just saying that out loud made me think of the peace plan that was offered this week. There you go. In the sense of, what do people want in a final agreement? And trying to negotiate out how to be fair and try to accommodate everybody's needs. Again, I've not. Have anybody read the 50-page plan? Okay, now that no one's read it, anybody got a view on it? Yes, of course. We've all got views on things. Everyone's got views on things. So it might be worth reading. But it's in fact, it should be. Say again. Oh, all right. Well, there we go. There's somebody already got a view. Right. So, it makes sense that it would be worth reading, at least to bolster one's views one way or other, or to at least be in the know of what it's about. I've been on a couple of calls this week of people explaining what it's about. I'm still not entirely clear on it. But either way, it's let's give it a go. Why not? Yeah. You can ask a slow question. Oh, good idea. Yes. Woo.
What about the all the Jews living in Goshen? Nothing affected? Did they see it? Were they affected by it?
This is a great question that I meant to touch upon last week and I did not. Because it is listed among one of the miracles of the experience was that the Jews didn't get hit by the plagues. There are only a few times when the psukim themselves, when the Torah itself says the Jews didn't suffer this. One being the plague we're discussing now. There was darkness in Egypt, and it says, but there was light in the area of the Jews. There is an assumption among a number of commentaries that actually some of the plagues did affect the Jews. One of those that has the most consensus that it affected the Jews was actually Kenim, was lice. That the lice was infected in the Jews' area as well. And the question might be, why on earth have they been hit by lice? There's some need to say they were affected by lice, because some of you may remember back in Bereshit, Yaakov said, please do me a favor, don't bury me in Egypt. Take me up to Israel. What was the reason he wanted to go up to Israel? Well, some of it was, that's where my family's buried, there's a nice plot that I've bought, and I've got a place to go. But there's also a midrash that he says, if you bury me in the land of Egypt, there's lice, there's plagues going to come out of the ground. I don't want to be involved. So the commentators say, well, he would have been buried in the Jewish area in Goshen, so why would he have been hit? They say, oh, the kingdom also affected the Jews. So there's a question, why did the kingdom affect the Jews? One view is that actually, if you don't get to wash very often and you're living in squalor, you get lice. So it's not that the Jews were struck by the plague, it's just that the Egyptians got to feel how the Jews were feeling, and the Jews weren't wandering around liceless, but that was part of their existence, and that got spread. Rabbi Shmuel Golden, who was the rabbi in Englewood, made Aliyah, retired a couple of years ago. He's written, I think it's all five volumes, called Unlocking the Text. Is this what it's called? It's like a goldish book about the Chumash, Bereishis, Shemot all the way through. It's called Unlocking the Text, and he asks some very interesting questions, and he gives an anthology of answers, and he assembles some answers on this, why the Jews were hit with Kinim. One of the answers suggested by one of the medieval commentators is that actually, where did the Kinim come from? They didn't arrive like the locusts by wind. Where did they come from? According to the text, what became lice? It was the dust of the ground, right? Meaning the sand grains, Moshe like did something and it all turned into lice. So actually, by giving them lice, what did the Jews no longer have, or the Egyptians no longer had to make the Jews do, was they couldn't make bricks anymore because there was no raw material. They say, you know, what, I'm going to make bricks out of lice now? So actually, by making them have the lesser of two evils, they had to deal with the Kinim, but at least they didn't have to work anymore. And that was the juncture which they no longer had to work. Yeah.
Geographically, where's Goshen?
Good question. Not sure. I've not been on a trip down to Egypt, although while I was in yeshiva, a couple of friends of mine did go for like their winter break on a trip to Egypt, which was not advised by the program I was in. It happens to be that one of my friends had a darker complexion, and if he took his kippah off and kind of wore not a, you know, a Yankees cap, but another hat of some sort, he could pass off without being held in suspicion. But either way, they went down. I've not been. I don't know where Goshen would be. I am 100% certain I've got three books with maps in them that would tell you exactly where they are. I actually have a couple upstairs in the office. But I don't have offhand where that would be described. Yeah.
One of the things that was defined by the Makot were the boundaries of Egypt. Then is Goshen within those boundaries, or the Makot not hitting Goshen, puts Goshen out of the boundaries of the land of Egypt?
I'm not sure. We'd have to take it to the UN so they can draw up new borders. But it's a good question. I'm not sure. So to finish off on the Kinim, the last view that Rabbi Golden suggests on his own, which again, take or leave any of these. He says, why do the Jews have to suffer some of the plagues? And his answer, which will resonate with some and will, the opposite of that, what's the opposite of resonate? I guess fall flat for others, is he says, God wanted to teach empathy. Part of this was not just about the Jews getting free. This was a pedagogical experience. God could have snapped his fingers, so to speak, released the Jews, over. What is the point of this protracted experience? What, 10 plagues? Why? Just let him go. Topple Pharaoh, regime change, do whatever you want, be done with it. And the idea, almost universally, is that these plagues were pedagogical. That at the very least, they were trying to teach Egypt and the wider world something about the presence of God, the providence of God, the capacity and power of God. But Rabbi Golden says it was also trying to train the Jews, teach the Jews things. And one of the things they were taught was, you're not going to have your enemies suffer here and just sit and watch with your little drinks and your umbrellas in. Which again, if I were a slave in Egypt, I would probably turn around and say, you know what, we're suffering. You know, we're not sitting here with our feet up. We don't have umbrellas in our drinks. You don't need to hit us with the plagues. But it was an interesting idea worth throwing out. Now, I see that we're marching on in time. So the rest of the parasha, stuff happens. After the darkness disappears, actually, it's interesting. We're then told one more plague is coming. It's going to be like there are going to be screams in Egypt that you've never heard before. And again, if you've seen Ten Commandments, you've seen the Prince of Egypt, you have this exchange. And at the end of the exchange, Pharaoh says, you're not leaving, leave. And then I just noticed yesterday, actually, it says, and Moshe left Bechori Af in a state of rage. Moshe left that final exchange in a state of rage. Why is Moshe angry? He seems to be the model of equanimity. He's a prophet. He knows what's going to happen. He's been told how this is going to go. And he's angry. What is he angry about? And I noticed, again, this was at midnight, at which point I was meant to be going to sleep, but it was kind of nagging at me. So I looked at a couple of things on my phone, and they had a couple of views on this. But I, this is what I shouldn't have done. I also got out YouTube and I thought, how do they do this in the movies? So I couldn't find the scene in the Ten Commandments for free, and I wasn't paying $15 for the movie that's 3.5 hours long so that I could watch through it at that point. But I saw the scene in The Prince of Egypt. There was a clip of it on YouTube. And the last exchange in that movie, Moses actually is in a state of deep compassion. You're saying Pharaoh, who was his brother in the context of the movie, or his adopted brother, says, please, I beg you, this is going to be so hard for you. You're bringing this on yourself. Nothing that's happened so far is going to prepare you for what's coming. You don't know what's happening. And they position it in very kind of foreshadowing. Again, it's animated, so they don't get the actors to move, but they have the Pharaoh's son standing at his side underneath a hieroglyphics of the Jewish babies being thrown into the river, with the river coming down and Pharaoh's son at the bottom. So they're foreshadowing what's about to happen to Pharaoh's son. There's a lot of content. And Moses walks away almost pained by what's happening, in a state of calm, in sympathy with this figure. That's not how the text presents it, that he leaves in a state of rage. One of the commentators I saw said, why was he angry? Because Pharaoh said, get out, I never want to see you again. Kind of took it personally, it looks like. There's another view that he was angry that Pharaoh wouldn't accept his argument. But there's something off balance, it seems. Again, I'm sure there's a lot more to see other than, you know, at midnight on Safaria. But either way, we're now told this is coming. And then there's a massive pause in the text. And we have Perek Yud Bet, where the Jews are given the first public mitzvah, which is the sanctification of the new moon. They're told how the Korban Pesach is going to work. They're told you have to eat matzah. Why do we have matzah on Pesach? Anybody know? Can't have chametz, that's true. Why is there a mitzvah to have matzah? What are we remembering? The Jews had to leave quickly. They had to run fast. They didn't have time. But we're told to have matzah before they left. They're told, you're going to have matzah. It's important. And then two chapters later, they have to run out and they didn't have time.
Yeah, but they went the next day. They had plenty of time to make bread.
So that's also true. Pragmatically, they had time, possibly. It's unclear when exactly they left. It says they left at night, and then it says the next day they left. One has to come to an accommodation. But also, they're told to have matzah as a mitzvah before they even undergo the experience of leaving. So it seems that it wasn't just by chance they didn't have time. In fact, at least according to Rashi, matzah had been eaten in Jewish circles for generations. Who's the first person who has matzah in the Torah? Lot. Right, that story of, well, Avram has the angels come, but it says they got some lechem. In Sodom, Lot is serving matzah. Maybe they just liked matzah in Sodom. But Rashi says Pesach haya. It was Pesach. It was Pesach in Sodom generations before they just went down to Egypt. But again, I'm not going to dive into that too late. I'm now going to dig myself out of that. And then the parasha happens. They go free. The firstborn are destroyed. They're killed. And then we have the mitzvah at the end. Tefillin's mentioned. Redeeming the firstborn is directly connected. The pidyon haben and pidyon chamor, the firstborn of donkeys and animals, is all connected to the fact God says, I destroyed the firstborn of Egypt, you now have to redeem your firstborn. Now, there's a lot to ask. Some of these plagues, all the plagues, are harsh, severe, terrifying, horrific. The idea that the firstborn children were targeted and wiped out is something that, at least for me, sits a little more uncomfortably, because it's very specifically targeted and targets babies in particular. Again, we weren't the recipients of sympathy from the Egyptians, but it seems like it's just cold revenge. How do we contextualize that? I'm not going to address that now, but it's a question that I think is worth pursuing. Now, over on the page that we have here, where we've got Moses and Pharaoh looking at one another, we'll spend just a few minutes on this. Because Moshe, a number of times, says, I'm not a man of words. I'm heavy of tongue. I'm heavy of mouth. I can't speak. I can't articulate. I can't defend. I can't be an advocate. And then in this moment, Moshe shows himself. And again, I couldn't find it because I couldn't get hold of the Ten Commandments clip. But this is, again, one of the central dramatic moments of Moses as liberator, when Pharaoh says, "Mi va mi aholchim," who's going? And this is right at the beginning again. When the locusts are about to come, Pharaoh's advisors say, "Look, he's come through on all these threats. The people are being beaten down. You need to do something." He says, "All right, fine, Moses, come back. Mi va mi aholchim," who's going? And what's Moshe's answer? If you were to give me in the most simple, pithy, brief answer, what's Moses' answer? Who's going, Moses?
Everyone.
So how would you say that in Hebrew? Kulanu, right? That would have been a pretty straightforward answer. Hakol kulanu. What does Moses say? This is in the top box. For Yom Moshe. Moshe said, "Bena'arenu vizkeneinu nelach." With our young and with our old, we will go. "Bivanenu bivnotenu." With our sons and with our daughters. But "Sanenu bivkarenu." With our sheep and with our cattle nelech, we will go. "Ki chag Hashem lanu," for it is a festival of God to us. At which point Pharaoh is sitting there thinking, is this being televised? What are you performing for me? I asked you a question, who's going? And you're saying, with our young and with our old, with our sons and with our daughters, with our cattle and with our sheep, we will go. Moses, chill. It's me and you. I'm asking you a question. Give me the answer. It seems like a very odd performative moment that's poetic, that's rhythmic, that's redundant, that's excessive, that again is almost out of character for Moshe in that moment. And again, Charlton Heston pulls it off very nicely. And again, I couldn't find it, but from memory, I think, because it did stick out that he says this, I think he doesn't look at Pharaoh for this. Pharaoh's then, there's a whole court, and Pharaoh says something, what's going to happen? And then Moshe turns around and he speaks to the crowd, saying, with our young and with our old, with our sons, with our daughters. And it's more for the people than for Pharaoh. He's not answering the question. It means he doesn't care what Pharaoh, he's trying to kind of permeate the people with some, whatever the good version of propaganda is, mean to let them know what we're thinking, that this is unjust and it needs to change. But in the text, it looks like he's just talking to Pharaoh, and it's an odd exchange. So what are we to make of it? Number one, what are we to make of the fact that Moshe seems to be poetic in a way that he isn't elsewhere, and also that he could have just said, "Kulanu, we're all going," but he has to get all kind of Shakespearean again. What is going on? And we don't have time to do it all inside, but the Balaturim says that this is some sort of prophetic exchange when Pharaoh says, I've got my magicians, I've got my necromancers, I've got my astrologers, I know how this is going to go. If I let you go and these plagues work, you're going to go out to the Midbar, and what are all the people going to do? They're going to sin. They're going to do the golden calf. God's going to say, all right, free pass, one time only. Then what are you guys going to do? Say again? Meraglim. You're going to have the spies. And what's going to happen as a result of the spies? You're all going to die. You're all going to die. And everybody, every single slave out here is going to die in the desert, with the exception of two people. Who's not? Kalev and Yehoshua. Moshe, I know you're not going to make it. You know you're not going to make it. We've had this prophetic vision. You've got your guys. I've got my guys. We know how this is going to go down. You want to make this whole fuss for two guys? Yeshua and Kalev? Mi va mi haholchem? For him and him, you're making this whole fuss? And he actually says that mi va mi haholchem is the same gematria as Kalev uvin nun, which again, Pharaoh Moshe speaking on a different plane, if they're kind of dealing with arithmetic, me va mi alchem, and he says, oh, I know what you're thinking about, Kalev and Ben Nun. Says, no, let me tell you. And the response is, what's Moshe's response? Pharaoh, this is what I'm talking about. You're right. The sin is going to result in Kalev and Yeshua being an exception. But there is a whole segment of society that you are ignoring. Because the only people who were punished as a result of the sin of the spies were those between 20 and 60, those of working adult age. Bena'arenu, vizkeinenu, nelech. The young and the old aren't going to die. And Pharaoh, this is typical. You only think of people you can exploit. You only think of people who can work. You only think of people you can take advantage of and you can use, who have utility. You don't think of human beings as human beings. And that's what I'm talking about. You're right. A whole generation of people aren't going to make it. But guess what? The young are going to make it and the old are going to make it, and they're worthy. They are worth of me overturning Egypt. They're worth me standing here every day and bringing plagues and forcing your hand to get out. Mi va mi aholchim? Who's going? I'll tell you who's going. Our young and our old are going. Our daughters and our sons and the animals too. So the Baal HaTorim has a limited solution for this pasuk, but it's an interesting one, so I thought I'd throw it out there. Yeah.
I mean, constantly Moshe saying, kulanu, kulanu, but in essence, it was only one-fifth of the population that left.
So it's an interesting point, and I guess like with my daughter, I'm going to have to say we'll have to wait for next week, because the source that four-fifths of the Jews died in Egypt was Chamushim, which is the beginning of next week's parasha, which can be read in a number of ways. But it's a fascinating idea that it said the Jewish people left Chamushim. What's the literal translation of Chamushim? Armed. They left with weapons. But there's a second reading. This is why they need to be armed. How much fighting did the Jews do in the desert? Not that much initially. God protected them. So Chamushim actually meant they left as a fifth. Four-fifths, Rashi says, died in the plain of darkness. And that was the whole point of the plague of darkness. Rashi says, on the darkness, why did they have darkness? What's the point? He says, two reasons there was darkness. Number one, so they could look through the homes and figure out when they come and say, give us money. And they say, oh, sorry, we're all out. Said, no, I've seen in the bathroom cabinet, you've got a bunch of stuff. Number one. And number two, so God could kill off the Israelites who didn't want to leave. That's Rashi. And the whole reason Rashi feels the need to justify darkness is that on its face, darkness don't seem so bad. I'm going to talk about this Shabbos morning. But when you've been thrashed by wild animals and by boils and by lice and by blood and by hail and by locusts, you turn the lights out. Oh, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to take a rest. This is a relief. What's so bad about darkness? And Rashi says, well, it was actually strategically necessary for a couple of reasons. There are other readings we'll talk about on Shabbos, but that's his basic answer. It was to knock out four-fifths of the Jews, which is an excellent question. It doesn't seem to be that everybody's going free. And when we talk about on Pesach, we've got the four sons, and we say, the Rasha, if you were there, you wouldn't have been set free. So there does seem to be a bar which we're saying, this was not just about freeing people. Actually, this clip I did see from the Ten Commandments while I was looking for the other one, at the foot of Mount Sinai, when Moshe comes down with the tablets, and I think he's called Dathan in the film, is standing on the thing saying, why are you giving us laws? We're free. And of course, Moses says, those who won't live by the law will die by the law, and throws it down and said, oh, there you go. So there was a misunderstanding on his part, and they all fall down. And so it does seem to be that this isn't just about freeing people who are being held against their will. This is about setting a people free to do something. I spoke about this at Surah Shlishit last week, the difference between negative freedom and positive freedom, freedom from and freedom to. And this is not just about freedom from oppression, but freedom to become a model people. And if they don't get that mission, it does not serve the purpose. But we'll turn back to that. The Ramban says that basically when Pharaoh says, who's going with, the assumption was, okay, you want to go for a religious festival. You have to send the priests, the cult leaders, some of the vicars, whatever you want to call them in Egypt. You need to send some of the religious leaders, folks. So give me the names. Meiv Amiel, who's going? And Moshe responds in the Ramban, so he's saying, no, we're all going. The religious festivals for us don't just involve the cult leaders, that we don't have a system where priests have power and other people don't. We all have a task, we all have roles, and we all have contact with God. We're all going. That's Ramban. The Abarbanel, we're not going to do inside. He basically says that Moshe wasn't sure what Pharaoh was asking. When he said, who's going? He didn't know if he meant which men are going. He didn't know whether he said, are the animals going? He didn't know if he meant, are the kids? So he just kind of threw everything out to answer all the ambiguities. So that if he said all of us, Pharaoh wouldn't think, oh, all of us, he says all the men. Meaning, I just want to clear up. We're all going. Our men, our old, our young, our daughter, everyone's going. That's his reading. The Malbim has a fascinating reading, which we're low on time, but it's the Malbim, so we have to do it. The Malbim says that this was a theological debate. In the old cults of the ancient world, there was an assumption there are two kinds of deity. There is a malevolent deity and a benevolent deity, and they don't meet. And the malevolent kind, the kind of the devilish gods who threaten and use malice and exploitation, and how do you get them on your side? How do you make sure they look after you? you appease them with blood and sacrifice. And if they get unhappy, these kind of devilish, malevolent forces, what do? They lash out and they kill things. But you just say, you kind of, anyone seen the Temple of Doom? Right? You walk in, those kind of gods, you've got to appease, you've got to rip out someone's heart, you've got to do it. That never made any sense to me. In the movie, you've got a rib cage, but whatever. Indiana Jones is what I'm talking about. There are those kind of gods, and then there are the benevolent gods who don't need to be appeased with blood, but need to be entertained and shown love and loyalty and experience celebration. So Pharaoh's saying, "Me v'mei holchem." Which kind of god is this? Who's going? Is it that kind of group? Are you sending the cult leaders with the animals to appease with sacrifices? In which case the kids aren't going, obviously, because you don't want the kids to get caught in the crossfire of an angry god. Or is it a benevolent god? In which case you don't need to take the animals. You just need the women and the children to celebrate and dance and kind of have nice family time. Me v'mei, who's going? And Moshe responds, again, we're all going. It's not just a statement, we're all going to go. It's a theological argument that we don't believe that there are malevolent deities and benevolent. There is a single, monotheistic, singular, cohesive, integral power that is responsible for the good in life, or what we experience as good and what we experience as bad. There is a single force. And we're all going because that kind of service is all-encompassing. We don't just like appease with sacrifices or have to entertain with celebration. We have a coherent religious life that adheres to the fact that there are moments that we can't understand, there are moments that we celebrate, there are moments that we mourn, and it's all from the same source. But I want to finish, having said the Malbim, with a reading that, again, I don't remember who. I saw it somewhere this week, but I've seen a few things and I don't remember where or who. That Pharaoh at this point, similar to the Baal HaTorim, is deeply cynical. And the advisors say, we need to let him go. Horrible things are happening. And Pharaoh says, fine, bring him back in. But Pharaoh's capricious. He's not really that interested. His advisors, I'm sure you can't think of any leaders who are like this, where advisors trying to push him to do things, they're not really interested. They don't have their heart in it. Said, all right, fine, bring Moshe back. And then in the conversation, before Pharaoh commits to anything and says, yes, fine, let's sort this out, he says, let's be honest here, Moshe. Before we even talk about this, before I give you a go-ahead, they're all pushing me to let you go. But just answer me this. I've looked out the window. I've seen the people out there. They're in desperation. They're wiped out. They're exhausted. They're worn down. I've seen these people. These are not people who live spiritually redemptive lives. And if I say you can go to go and serve this God in the desert, which means, who do you think is going to go? Who do you honestly think is going to go? This whole thing's a fool's errand. You've come here to free. They don't want to go free. They don't have the energy to go and serve a god. They're slaves. This is all they've ever known. This is all they ever do. Yeah, they probably don't enjoy it. But if I say go and serve God, they're just going to say, you know what? I'm just going to stay. This is what I'm used to. It's what, again, I don't want to overdo the movies, but it's what one movie called Becoming Institutionalized. You don't know how to survive on the outside. You don't know how to survive in a free world where you've got responsibilities and autonomy. This is how, who's going to, Miva Milchim, who's going to go? And in that context, Moshe's answer is, as Charlton Heston has it, profoundly optimistic. He says, you don't understand the Jewish spirit. You don't understand that every single one of those slaves is going to stand up and say, let's go on our mission. They are resilient, perseverant, optimistic, and hopeful. If you tell them they're going to go free, I'm telling you, Pharaoh, you look out the window and you see slaves. I see souls dying to get out. We're going to go with the young and the old, and our sons, and our daughters, and our cattle, and we're going to live here. This is not what these people were born to do. They are crying to break free, desperate for a new life, to have meaning, and a mission, and purpose, and not be just slaves. And you have misunderstood what it means to be human, what it means to be Jewish, and we're going to show you that every single one of us is going to leave. And that's just an interesting way to end off that scene. Next week, we're going to have to talk about, hold on a minute, did they all go? We'll talk about that next week. In the meantime, I wish you all a good Shabbos, a good end to the week.